TFM.
Welcome, Stargazers, to another episode of The Artificial Tango, our dedicated Star Trek Picard podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he always is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. And Matthew, can you please do me a favor and stop doing that red, glowy eye thing? It's really making me nervous.
Oh, I'm sorry, Chris. Am I not supposed to use my laser vision in here?
It's just making me very uncomfortable. You know, I'm having flashbacks to fire caves and all kinds of stuff.
I'm so sorry. It was not on purpose. You know, sometimes I just can't control it. You know, the eyes just kind of like to do what they like to do. And I'm so sorry. I'll try to keep that under control from now on.
Okay, thank you. I will feel much more comfortable in today's discussion. Yes, everyone, we are continuing our watch of Season 3 of Star Trek Picard as it unfolds today with Episode 5, Imposters. And I'm pretty certain Matthew is not an imposter, not a changeling that I'm podcasting with today, but we'll find out. And we'll also maybe tie into those red, glowy eyes as we go along. So, Matthew, there are so many topics to talk about in this one, and the big surprise, which it was incredible that they kept this hidden all this time, and that was the appearance of Ro Laren coming aboard to play a part in this story. And I have to say that when they said that this security officer is insisting on a shuttle, first of all, I thought about Bones and how he wanted to use a shuttle. So it's kind of like a playful little callback to that. But more importantly, there was some reason why this person didn't want to use the transporters. And so I started trying to think, who is it? Who could it be? Who could it be? I was not expecting it to be Ro Laren.
Yeah, you know, I don't know if anybody could have called this, in all honesty. This does, you know, just a massive surprise. I think everybody watching the episode, most likely, there was a moment of like, you know, just like, oh, wow, that is not what I was thinking this was going to be. And, you know, one of the things, it's interesting because, you know, Metallus had mentioned that there were going to be other people that showed up and that you were going to, you know, see people that you did not expect. And so I think having Ro show up was fantastic. And I think, too, I wanted to ask you, Chris, because I've seen some commentary about this around the internet. How do you feel like the portrayal of the relationship here with Picard and everything that had happened with them fits with, say, you know, where we left Ro with Preemptive Strike? And the nature of their relationship in general, because obviously that's a huge key piece to the interaction we get with her and Picard, the pain that they caused one another.
Yeah. Well, I think that the portrayal worked fine for me. I think that it may feel like there's a deeper level of familiarity between the two of them than what we would expect based on what we've seen on The Next Generation, just in the sense that the feeling that she had that he was always judging her, and she felt that weight from him as she served aboard the Enterprise, and also the fact that, you know, he says, I've been practicing this conversation for 30 years when he speaks Bajoran to her, which indicates that the way things were left with Ro has kind of weighed on him for a long time. And I don't know that I would have necessarily have thought about that just based on what we saw of Ro in The Next Generation. But it makes sense. And I think that it reflects the reality that often gets missed, especially on a show like The Next Generation, where it's purely episodic and you are just going to solve some crisis on this planet or that planet or mediate this or that or whatever from week to week, and you're not really delving deeply into the characters. And it's like we're dropping in on them and we're just seeing these moments in their lives. But you know that they're actually living out their lives every day, and there's all kinds of stuff that happens, and there's all kinds of conversations that they have that we don't see. And therefore, that like feeling of deeper familiarity and maybe regret on Picard's part, also maybe a little bit of anger on Picard's part because he feels like she betrayed the Starfleet principles. And then on her side, also that feeling that he was judging her makes sense to me.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was a long-winded answer, but there you go.
No, I think it's excellent, actually. And I think it's something which, you know, after this episode came out, I had to go back and rewatch Preemptive Strike because I didn't feel like I could actually, I didn't really have a firm grasp on, you know, where we had left the characters. And you know what had happened. It's been a long time since I've watched through TNG, from start to finish, especially. And so, because of that, I went back and I actually watched the episode again to get a sense of, okay, what is the relationship like with these characters? And what I found is that in the betrayal, especially between Michelle Forbes and Patrick Stewart, there is a real sense of familiarity with these characters in a way that Picard doesn't necessarily show to a lot of people. Picard is very invested in this character, in this person. He treats her as somebody he's mentoring, but I think even more so than that, there is a, I think, familial bond that's there, which, again, I think harkens back to everything that Picard we've seen of this character. He has not been a father, but he has been a father figure and played that role to many people. And then even that was accentuated when Riker comes in and tells Picard what happened. And the episode ends just on Picard's face. And Patrick Stewart, the way he doesn't say anything, it's just that look of utter anguish and pain and hurt and anger and all of those things wrapped up in betrayal, all wrapped up into one. And even the scene of, you know, they meet at that bar and, you know, they're having the conversation about what she's going to do, and they are intimately close, mainly because of the roles that they're playing in that moment. But there's something else going on there too. And so everything that they said here after watching that episode and then seeing the episode here again, I felt like Metallus had completely tapped into all the stuff that doesn't get said in that episode and played it out perfectly here. And I think that in Picard and in, you know, newer Trek, and I think even Deep Space Nine, I think really starts this, right? Which is this trend of characters being slightly more damaged and hurt, and that the situations that they go through actually cause them real pain, right? We started that with Sisko forward. And so I think that this fits perfectly with what we've been given. And then to see this in the episode, which I thought was also a brilliant move, which Metallus and the writers use this as a way for them to make clear that you couldn't be a changeling and fake this. And I think that's something that makes this then a really special thing. And I think also too, it's it becomes one of those things that as a fan, you didn't necessarily know you wanted, which is a resolution to this story for these two characters. And I like it. I like it a lot, bringing her in. And again, I think I was really shocked when I went back because, you know, like, I think Star Trek Picard specifically, especially even in season one with the whole thing about the way Picard felt about Data, felt a little out of date for me. And I felt like they were milking a little bit too much. Here, I don't think they milked anything at all. I don't think they accentuated the relationship at all. I think this felt phenomenal and really worked. So,
yeah, no, I agree. And I did not have a chance to go back and watch Preemptive Strikes. I've been trying to just, you know, of course, I've seen the episode many times, but it's been a long time. So as you describe what happened there, it comes back to me more. I guess I would encourage everyone to go watch Preemptive Strike and then go back and watch this episode again.
100%.
Because the thing about this being something that we didn't know was coming, and it relies heavily on an episode from 30-something years ago, of course our memories of it would be not fresh. And clearly, as you discovered when you went and watched it, there is a lot of impact there if your memory of what happened, and in particular, the facial expression of Patrick Stewart at the end.
Oh, it's just
really
so,
informs it, a lot, and that kind of stuff is not usually clear.
Heartbreaking, man. It's just legitimately, Stewart's so good, yeah. Right? Like, I don't need to tell anybody that, but well, that scene.
And he tells her in this one that you broke my heart, right? So that ties exactly into the moment that you're talking about from Preemptive Strike. So,
yeah.
It's good. I think that the choice, I guess you could pull off the are they a changeling or not thing with other characters, but I feel like because of this relationship that we're discussing, she was a really good choice for this part of the story where they really, I think, do a great job of making us think that Ro is a changeling because she's not wearing the earring. She's really interested in Jack, who she would have not known about until recently as well, right? And the way that she speaks to Riker and Picard, then when they're going down the corridor and she pulls the phaser on him and says, let's go into the holodeck. All up to that moment, you really feel like, yeah, she might be. And also when Beverly calls up and tells Picard that, you know, your results are here and he checks it. And she tells him that they can pass the traditional blood test. And then the moment that Beverly and Dr. Oak find out that if you dissect enough, then the organs will turn liquid and the changelings can pass the blood test. Then visually, they immediately cut to Ro and Picard. So there's that visual suggestion to you that, Ro's a changeling. And then Beverly calls up Picard, trust no one. It's just all done really well. And the intimacy of the relationship between Ro and Picard, the details that they know, like you were saying, are kind of necessary to really show that the situation is very bad with Starfleet and Ro needed someone that she could trust. And that was Picard, but she had to make sure that he's Picard. And then Picard has to make sure that this is actually Ro. And I feel like in the writing and in the directing and the editing, the cuts and all, that they really played it well.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. Well, and I think too, you know, there's something that's the conversation that they end up getting to have as well. You know, I think Ro does a very good job of challenging Jean-Luc And, you know, she says that blind faith in any institution does not make one honorable. Mm-hmm. And that Sean Luke has many times confused morality with duty, mm-hmm. which I think we have seen with Sean Luke. Yeah. And in many ways, too, what's interesting is that the Jean Luc of the films began to make that change, right? I mean, I think Insurrection is the moment in which Jean Luc truly was willing to turn his back on Starfleet because it mm-hmm. was doing what was immoral, right?
Right, right.
And in many ways had become more like Roe. And I think what's fascinating is that, you know, you get that last scene between them on the bridge as she knows she's going to die. And he finally recognizes the reason that she had gone to join the Maquis. And even though he might not necessarily have made that choice, that she had done it for what she believed to be the correct moral reasons, right? And that, you know, that moment where he says, I see you. And it's just so, I mean, if mm-hmm. it's not tearing your heart out at that moment, you're probably dead. And right. so I just really appreciate the way in which they take something that was deep and continue that depth. And then they, and you know, to utilize this character. And then, of course, you know, Ro dies. We kill her off. And give her this beautifully honorable death, because what is she doing? She is fighting to protect the thing that she always believed in, even if she didn't necessarily do it the same way Jean-Luc did, that they've been doing the same things, upholding what they, the same morals and principles, just going about it in a different mm-hmm. way. And so it creates, I think, this incredibly robust story. And with this being the end of the Next Generation, that's the goal of this, to bring it to a close. I think bringing in the character of Ro and doing it in this way is made this really special.
Mm, yeah. Well, and they chose someone who has a real meaning for Jean-Luc Picard rather than, I mean, you could make a list of which characters do you hope show up in the season.
Right.
I don't think Ro Laren would have been in the top 10 on many people's lists, right? But the character works for the story and actually gives meaning to the story, so it's not just a fan service cameo mm-hmm. moment.
100%.
Yeah.
Well, and then, you know, the cool part here is that her earring connects this all together, right? Her earring lets us understand that the conspiracy mm-hmm. that she's brought to Jean-Luc, that is now at the highest order of Starfleet, goes all the way up the food chain. Mm-hmm. You know, the changelings are everywhere, and they have, seems like, big plans for Frontier Day, which the entire fleet's going to be on display. And of course, you know, you're like, oh, well, this would be a perfect way to destroy all of Starfleet, or mm-hmm. cripple it in a way that would be almost insurmountable.
Yeah.
Very easily.
Which, and from a logistical security standpoint, isn't it a really bad idea to get your entire fleet together in one place? And imagine with Starfleet being scattered mm-hmm. around at least the Alpha and Beta quadrants, and mm-hmm. probably at this point elsewhere, the logistics of just bringing everybody back. Like, let's all have a block party at Earth. Yeah.
Well, and I think I 100% get what you're saying, but I also think what this does, when we see how big this conspiracy is, this retroactively changes the entire run of Picard,
mm-hmm.
right? Because these changelings would have had to have been in at this for a very long time. So the reaction that we got in season one to what happened with the Romulans and all of that, a lot of this,
that's a really good point. Yeah.
Could really have been all because the changelings have slowly and surely been infiltrating Starfleet. And so, yeah, you're right. It's completely stupid to get the entire fleet together. But when everybody or all the people in power needing to make that happen, and especially since we know from Roe that the plans for Frontier Day are classified, then it makes complete sense why you could pull this off then.
Yeah.
They've been playing the long, long game here.
Yeah. Well, yeah, when Roe says that the plans are still classified, at that moment you know that, yeah, someone at the very top is a changeling. Probably multiple people are changelings.
Right.
And like you say, they're making this plan and keeping it under wraps. But the idea that the changelings would still be harboring resentment towards the Romulans from the Dominion War and what happened in DS9 and therefore had that reaction
exactly
in season one of Picard, that's a really interesting way of rethinking what we saw in season one.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Which is, this is exact, like, you want whatever you're doing to retroactively make everything else better. And so I'm not a huge fan of season one, which, you know, I think maybe, you know, when we're finished with season three, we'll go back and talk about season one because then we might be able to see it in a completely different light.
Yeah.
But this is exactly what you want, right? You want that, what's you're doing now, to actually make sense of the story back then that may have not made as much sense until you got here.
Mm-hmm.
That's fantastic writing, if you ask me, which is really special. You know, I think that what's great about this, too, is that we also learn that Ro is what connects the rest of this, all of the story together now, right? Which has been going on with Rafi and Worf. All of that connects here, which maybe it's a good time that we could quickly talk about their story because it connects so well.
Well, okay. So then as a bridge to that, I wanted to ask you, Rafi didn't know who her handler was, and then she discovers that it's Worf. And Worf seems also, when he's talking to Rafi most of the time, to not know who his handler is. Like, it it feels like that's how it works, right? Like, you don't know who your handler is all the way up.
Right.
Except near the end, when Worf comes on the screen and talks to Riker and Picard, he immediately asks, where's Commander Ro?
Yeah.
Like, as if he knew. And I don't know. Maybe he knew. I felt like that was a little bit of a slip to have that connection to Commander Ro in the Next Generation cast that Worf mentions her name, because it seems like he shouldn't have known who she was. Because he was surprised. I felt like he didn't know who he was going to see on the other side. And then he was really surprised that it was Riker and Picard.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring that up, because as I was rewatching the scene when they're on the La Serena and, you know, they're talking to the handler, I could understand how you could maybe think that Worf doesn't know, but as I was watching it, I was realizing I think Worf expects, because it's Ro and he knows it's Ro, that they're going to be given the okay to go to Daystrom Station. And I think that's what's surprising him, is that she's saying no to that and basically doing to him what he was doing to Rafi earlier, that they have to find another way to do this. And part of that is what we realize now, is that this conspiracy is so much bigger than we ever knew. And I think it's actually even bigger than Worf knows at this point, until he's, you know, I'm guessing that he's going to, well, of course he's going to meet up with Picard in the next episode. You know, I think they're all going to finally get together for the most part.
It's definitely bigger than Worf knows, because Worf was surprised to discover that that human was a changeling. So I don't think Worf has any idea that there are changelings all over the place.
Right. Yeah. 100% agree with you. But I loved their story, and I thought this was really interesting. First, I mean, I really appreciate, I think Worf and Rafi work really well together.
Yeah,
I think
they
found a real connection, and I think there's real chemistry between the actors, and so that's really fun. But the fact that they run into this Vulcan criminal element was fascinating, because this is something that we've said all the way back, I think, to Deep Space Nine and beyond. When logic is all you're using, you can logic your way into believing anything. Mm-hmm. It's the danger of logic being the only thing there, which is why, of course, Spock tells Valeris that, you know, it's only the beginning of wisdom. Mm-hmm. And so Kryn being able to think himself logically, whether or not it's actually logical that a utopia would have a criminal element, which I would argue with him, if it's a utopia, why would you need a criminal element?
Yeah, but that line I thought was a bit odd. I listened to it a couple times and it didn't land with me. So anyway, then I moved on. But
yeah, but I think one, Kryn was awesome. And then Kirk Acevedo playing him. I've seen him in many things before. He's phenomenal. And he just does such a great job of playing that Vulcan who's like on the edge of emotion. Mm-hmm. And the fact that, you know, he's from the Bronx as well kind of gives him that kind of like, you know, gangster vibe that we're also used to. So I thought it was like this whole part of the story was great.
Yeah, it was great. And it's good to see a Vulcan portrayed that way, because again, it breaks down that Star Trek thing that we talk about often, where an entire race is portrayed as being the same. And we've gotten a little bit of variety in Vulcans, but not too much. And I would say that even the way that Tavin, the science officer on the Titan, plays mm-hmm. a Vulcan is very much like TOS Spock Vulcan,
yeah,
right?
She
like plays that way. So here we get some real variety, and I think it makes a lot of sense that you would have something like that. But the Worf-Raffi storyline, yeah, I was glad to see us come back to it. Last time we talked about whether we thought it was the right mm-hmm. thing to not do any of it in the previous episode, and you just stay focused on what's happening on the Titan. And we both felt that was the right thing to do. Here, the cutting back and forth between the two storylines, I think, worked well. You didn't feel a disruption from one or the other. And then ultimately, they do tie together mm-hmm. at the end. So that worked well. Did you see when Worf is looking up who they might go to get more information?
Yes.
Did you read the names on the screen, the mm-hmm. list in the criminal database?
Yep.
I
Runt's
love,
on there.
Morn is on there.
Yes.
Morn of Luria.
Yes.
And then also Okona.
Mm-hmm.
The Thadian Okona of Omega is on there. I thought that was really fun. And at first I thought it's a list of serious criminals like Sneed was. Mm-hmm. But actually, I think it's more like some criminals or some characters, unusual characters, right? Because although Morn was involved in the heist, I don't really think of him as being a criminal
right.
that you would really need to hunt down. And the same for Okona. He's just kind of a rogue that gets into trouble, but he's not like a mm-hmm. criminal.
Yeah.
I'm surprised they didn't put Harry Mudd on the list.
That you know, yeah, that's interesting. You know, I think one of the things that's great here is that, of course, we talk about the flaws that are in the Daystrom Station, and that Kryn had a special device that allowed him to be able to get past it. So I mean, come on, Moriarty's got to be the AI security, right?
Yeah, you're probably right. Yeah.
Which makes me wonder if that's too how we're going to, you know, get Lore involved. And in the end, I don't think they're actually going to be villains. I think they're actually going to be people that surprisingly help us in our mission rather than hinder us.
So do you think they're even going to play the AI security thing? I hadn't thought about that. That's a really good point that would make sense because, and spoiler alert for anyone who's doesn't want to know, we've not seen anything, so we're just speculating. And they showed us Moriarty and Lore in the trailer. And I started thinking now, Matthew, though, with this changeling storyline, I started wondering if not 100%, I do think they'll appear, of course, but was the reveal of these two characters in the trailer sort of a red herring to throw us off of what the real story was going to be? Because ever since the trailer came out, fans have been wondering, like, oh, wow, Lore? Moriarty? Mm-hmm. Wow, this is going to be like a wild story. All kinds of stuff going on. And now we've seen half of the story, and there's no trace of them at all. And I really cannot believe that they're going to come in and become a major part of the story in the final five episodes. So the idea that maybe the AI is based, it could be based on both of them, actually.
It could be.
With Lore being an android and Moriarty being the code of a hologram program that has some sort of sentience to it. The reference to AI feels very contemporary because right now, everything you hear in the news is AI. It's ChatGPT. I thought that maybe the AI security for this Daystrom station is ChatGPT 47. It's the 47. You know, they just released the fourth version, GPT-4, last week as we're recording this. So it would have been, you know, early March, mid-March. But no, what you say, but talking about AI, it's the big topic right now. So I feel like that's thrown in there because of that. But if you really want to have it make sense, I like your idea. Otherwise, I'm wondering, where are they going to show up, right?
Yeah, no, 100%. I love that you have the use of the mobile emitter. So apparently by this point, we can create more mobile emitters, which is very cool. Although I would think that you could hide the mobile emitter under some clothing, so it's not so obvious.
It's the fashion, Matthew. If you've got a mobile emitter,
it's true.
You got to wear it on your arm and just show it off.
Forget having your heart on your sleeve. Yeah. You got to have your mobile emitter on your
sleeve. That's a 25th century space bling.
Exactly.
Show it off.
Interesting, though, Worf has mentioned a couple of times what he has sacrificed for this mission. And I'm wondering what that is. Is it that he sacrificed his place in the Klingon Empire? Are we going to learn that somebody close to him has died again, like his son? I mean, what has he sacrificed? But you get the feeling as though Worf has basically put everything on the line once he learned from Odo that this infiltration was happening. And, and it seems like it's been pretty substantial loss.
Yeah.
Or sacrifice.
I took it as potentially him referring not only to this mission, especially now that he knows that it's the changelings, but going back into the Dominion War as well. Because if you think about the suffering that he endured at the hands of the Jem'Hadar, the founders during the Dominion War, the loss of Jadzia, his entire identity as a Klingon was turned on its head by Ezri. He ends up slaying Gowron. Then his life goes on from there off screen to get him to where we see him now. I felt like it's a long history of what he sees as sacrifices in his life at the hands of the changelings, going back into the DS9 story. At least to me, I thought of that as being a part of it. And then, maybe there is something more specific, more recent as part of the mission that he's on right now. But I read it as stretching back even further, and especially given how many references they're making to past Star Trek, the idea of losing Jadzia, it made sense to me that that would still be there for him as a sacrifice.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that that way, because I think there's real validity to that. And I think of, you know, the classic story for the Cardassians is called The Never-Ending Sacrifice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
So I think in some ways, I think that that might sum up the story of our Starfleet characters, you know, that their life is full of never-ending sacrifice. They are constantly giving up things for the greater good. And so to me, I think that really speaks to what you're saying about Worf there, and that his life has been full of sacrifice, right? And some of it has been intentional, and some of it has been unintentional, and some of it's just been tragic loss. And yet all of it is very much a part of who he is. And I think that's interesting, because then Worf and Rafi being on this journey together, you know, Rafi has sacrificed much for Starfleet and for the greater good. I mean, even in this season, she has been asked to choose between maybe being able to have a relationship with her son again or saving the Federation as we know it, right? And she's made the difficult choice. And so, again, putting these two characters together and both of them having made quite a bit of sacrifice, I think is really interesting. I think it's also something to which speaks to the characters of TNG, Deep Space Nine, Voyager, and the, you know, that Berman 24th century. That's what their lives were marked by, is sacrifice. And so, yeah, I think that's really well said.
Mm. Another thing about the changelings I wanted to ask you about before we get into, I guess, the big thing that I'm looking forward to discussing, which is Jack, is the idea of changeling continuity, how they're portraying the changelings, because Beverly says that when a changeling dies, it reverts back to liquid form. But on DS9, we would see changelings turn to ash. So do you feel like that's just a visual update, or is it some discrepancy in the story, or is it a different kind of death? Like, I can see if a changeling was reabsorbed by the Great Link, but we saw other situations where a changeling would actually die and it goes to ash. Personally, kind of think of it as just being a cost thing. Like, it makes more sense if the changelings revert back to some kind of goo. But in 1990s television, I imagine the cost of showing that happening would have been very expensive, and it was maybe easier just to do the ash. But do you read anything into that, and maybe a connection to this evolution of the changelings to be able to mimic organs and retain their form after they've been killed?
I think it is a great question, because with what we've seen, like you said, in previous iterations, the changelings that I'm thinking of that die, we do see them starting to turn into some kind of ash. The only other changeling that I'm thinking of is the one that is dying, that turns into liquid that creates Odo into Odo again as a changeling,
right?
Brings him back to his changeling form. I'm wondering if it depends on how a changeling dies.
That's what I was wondering,
And so so if a changeling is, you know, killed with a phaser and it's not on kill, that it would revert to its natural form and liquid. I think, you know, there are definitely a lot of questions that have to be answered here, but these changelings do seem to be quite different in the sense that they can, down to a much more detailed level, mimic solids in a way that they haven't been able to do before. And, you know, I think because the season has been so good, any slight discrepancies there might be with changelings before, and now I'm maybe willing to let go. But in the end, too, I'm also reminded of how little we know exactly how changelings work in the first place. And so, I mean, I think this, you know, just watching it, it feels generally consistent with or doesn't seem to completely contradict things that I've heard before. And so it doesn't really bother me too much.
And it makes sense
in that sense.
Right. And it makes sense that they would revert to liquid. That makes more sense than them turning to ash. And for this story, you need them to revert to, or you need to eventually get it to go into some kind of liquid state to be able to identify that these were changelings. So it all works for the story. Now, the ability of these changelings to mimic internal organs and to hold their shape after they've been killed, to really pass all the tests so that humans don't know, or solids, I guess, would be a more accurate thing to say, don't know that these are changelings. That's a pretty big jump in ability and evolution for the time scale that we're looking at from the end of the Dominion War until now, which makes you wonder if someone else is involved and someone has manipulated them. We see all of the DNA strands and the genetic references and all in the closing credits. Now, Beverly says there's no DNA representation at all in this corpse of the changeling LaForge, but it makes you wonder, though, if there's some kind of manipulation going on behind the scenes.
However the changelings have evolved, it would make sense for something to be going on genetically because we have seen in the credits this whole thing about genetic strands. And so for there to have been some kind of upgrade, possibly not naturally, but in a genetics type of way to changelings to create this difference, I think makes complete sense for the story here.
Well, and also the fact that it's been said that this is a renegade group of changelings, not the Great Link, right? And so it would make sense that someone has modified a group of changelings to carry out this mission. Now, Jack's role in all of this is very intriguing, and after I finished watching the episode the first time, I sent you a text message and I said, just watch the episode. Wow. And I said, so Jack is a changeling and he doesn't realize he's a changeling. Is that maybe what's going on? But then you have another theory, which I think fits what we're seeing visually and fits the story that you and I know so well. And I don't know, do you want to talk about that now? Because, you know, at the beginning, I was joking about your eyes glowing red. And one thing that we've seen from Jack is that occasionally his eyes glow red. And also, there's a lot of mystery behind his origin. And I've still, as the last couple of episodes have unfolded, I'm still not completely sold on the idea that he is actually Jean-Luc's son and that maybe there's some other way that he came about with Beverly.
Yeah, I like to call him Jack in the Box because there's a mystery box aspect to this character. And my theory about Jack from everything that we've seen is that the Paw Wraiths have made him into their anti-emissary. You know, the last time we saw the Paw Wraiths, they had been locked in the fire caves by Captain Sisko. And my thought is that they helped conceive him, would make sense, of Beverly, who in the 24th century getting pregnant seems very implausible because, you know, if you don't want to get pregnant, it's very easy to not get pregnant at that point in time. You know, like contraception, if you don't want to get pregnant, It's not hard in the 25th century. And I also think that this kind of helps explain some ideas that the changelings have evolved, that the paw wraiths are involved there. When we, it makes sense of Valak's hand then too,
right? Yeah,
that there's something else behind all of this. That it's not just these renegade changelings; it's actually the paw wraiths. You know, we know that because the paw wraiths were locked in the caves. I'm guessing that these renegade changelings ran across. We've seen other in Deep Space Nine paw wraiths locked in artifacts, and that one was released from an artifact, and now Jack would be the key to them being unlocked from the fire caves, which makes sense of why we would keep seeing these weird flashes of a door.
Mm-hmm.
He keeps getting called to, you know, find us, reunite us. Also, I think this is the thing, too, is that I don't want to take away, and I don't think the creators want to take away the whole storyline of him actually being their son.
Mm-hmm.
So, Jack actually being Picard's son is a damning thing against Starfleet and the Federation, whose greatest representation is Jean-Luc Picard. And I think it makes sense of the title where we have all these DNA strands. And I also continue to wonder if this might have something to do with the Enterprise E's final mission, which we know from the Starfleet logs Instagram was classified. And so also, too, I'm wondering, do they need something from Daystrom Station, a Bajoran artifact that would help them be released?
Mm-hmm.
And them being released then would turn, you know, the galaxy into fire and ash and whatever else. Mm-hmm. And so this would be their ultimate payback for the paw wraiths, basically, against the prophets, against the Federation. And having these renegade changelings involved makes sense as well. Why wouldn't they want to get even with or get one up on the Federation?
Mm-hmm.
And it also, too, again, just the whole idea that the changelings might be modified in some ways by the paw wraiths.
Well, that's what I feel.
Is also makes sense to me. So, I mean, it's a interesting theory. I obviously they could do something completely different, but it just seemed to fit all the facts that we have involved.
Yeah, yeah. No, it makes sense to me. And if you remember Dukat's eyes glowing red he's possessed by the paw wraiths, and Jake Sisko as well, in The Reckoning, we saw where the Kos Damajan took over his body, and we know that it's possible for the paw wraiths to possess bodies like this, and also to come and go. Like, the thing is that I feel with Jack that he doesn't know what's happening to him. Right. The visuals of this episode were really interesting because it opens with him killing the bridge crew of the Titan.
Right.
But he's wearing the Starfleet uniform. And then you realize that, no, he's actually in his quarters or wherever. And he's wearing his regular civilian clothes, but he is holding the phaser and he looks shocked, like, why am I holding this? And then later there's that vision where it seems like he kills the transporter operator, but then he doesn't. And the transporter operator asks him if he's been ordered to beam over to the Intrepid, and he seems kind of lost. And then he comes back and says, oh, no, no. Is there somewhere else I can go, anywhere that's not a Starfleet ship?
Right.
And then when Seven gives him the Starfleet uniform, because Picard has asked her to hide him in plain sight by having him dress as an officer, when he opens the bag and he sees the uniform, he is kind of taken aback. And I thought that Ed Spilliers, the actor playing Jack, did a really nice job just with his eyes of conveying that he's really frightened by the idea of this uniform.
Mm-hmm.
But why is not clear. You know, it could be because he remembers the visions and he knows that that happened while he was wearing the uniform. And then this is the next step in that vision coming true. And he doesn't want to go down mm-hmm. that path. Or it could be that he's a changeling and he definitely doesn't want to wear a Starfleet uniform because he cannot step into the clothes of the enemy in that way. It's not clear, you know, why he's having this reaction. And right. so I think that whatever is happening to Jack, he's very confused by it himself.
Yeah.
So something is possessing him or something from his origins are calling out to him. And the visuals do have this Pa-Wraith connection, which is why your theory mm-hmm. was very interesting to me, because it could also be, you know, the idea, like you said, that the Pa-Wraiths caused Jack to be born as their anti-emissary is a really interesting way of showing a parallel to the Sisko story where the prophets caused him to come about and be born to be their emissary. And so just as this season is retelling a lot of classic Star Trek storylines with twists, that would be another one to retell. And can you imagine if they got the ultimate cameo and Sisko came back and Avery Brooks showed up?
It would be amazing. I've thought about that with this theory and I'm like, that would be awesome.
I cannot see that happening. I don't see Avery Brooks agreeing to do it. But
yeah,
once we started thinking about this theory, I started thinking, you know, if they really wanted to pull out a super surprise, I think mm-hmm. everyone would yeah. be shocked if they were able to pull off that casting.
That might break the internet.
Yeah.
So, you know, a couple of other things that stood out to me in this theory. You know, the prophets and the Pa-Wraiths always approach people in guys that they know,
mm-hmm.
and so. You know, Sisko is approached by people that look like his mother or mm-hmm. they looked like, you know, things like that. And the voiceover
mm-hmm.
that's being heard is his mother.
Yeah, yeah.
And we also have seen that the Pa-Wraiths are not above showing people visions to try and get them to do what they want people to do.
Mm-hmm.
They did that to Sisko. So, again, all of this just... Again, all of this just really seemed to fit everything that we're seeing with this character. And, you know, it would be fascinating to me for them to kind of go down this road, which is so heavily reliant on Deep Space Nine, more so really than it is TNG,
mm-hmm.
except for the characters involved. So, you know, I'm not sure exactly altogether how I would feel about if they didn't ever involve any Deep Space Nine actors then in this story. I think I would mm-hmm. be kind of upset if that's the case. And this was true, but I don't know, but what I'm most interested in the fact is that Metallus has talked about this bringing all the series together, DS9, TNG, Voyager. And it's very interesting that so much of this story is really hearkening back to DS9
mm-hmm.
heavily, which I don't think surprises either of us if you want to tell a good 24th century story.
Right, yeah. But it is surprising in that if you take the average Star Trek fan, among TNG, DS9, and Voyager, DS9 is the series that the least number of fans have seen. Most everyone has seen TNG and then Voyager, but there are so many fans who skipped DS9 because they watched a few episodes and they didn't really get into it. And Voyager was on the TV at the same time, so you've got two Trek series on for most of that run. And there are going to be a lot of fans who are not familiar with the storyline of DS9. And yet here, even if we're wrong about the Pa-Wraith angle, the changeling thing is happening. That is the main storyline. And if you didn't see DS9, you'd be wondering, well, who are the changelings, right? What, why do they want some kind of revenge on the Federation? So it's an interesting choice to like build the core of your story around the series that had the least number of viewers.
And I think, though, the reason they did that is because unless you were going to bring back the conspiracy parasites, the changelings mm-hmm. are the biggest threat to the Federation in mm-hmm. the sense of being this insidious enemy that could so easily pass by security measures, mm-hmm. Especially with the, you know, what we've seen of these changelings here. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and Deep Space Nine was just, again, I think it was more about building the entire universe of Star Trek other than just what happens in Adventure on each show mm-hmm. and the impact of that, you know, other than, you know, I think the Borg and Wolf 359, which is still a big part of what happened in the Star Trek universe, DS9 for the Alpha and Beta quadrants has a much bigger resonance in storytelling and, you know, touching Klingon Empire, Romulan Empire, Bajorans, Cardassians, now the Gamma Quadrant. I mean, it's like, it's so far reaching in where the stories went and what it did with the universe. It's just actually so much bigger than what TNG did with the universe in many ways. And so it makes sense, again, that you would be relying on that storytelling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You mentioned the parasites from Conspiracy, and I did hear speculation and chatter even after a couple of episodes had aired, people thinking like maybe that's what's going on. Maybe those parasites are going to be part of the story. And it almost feels like, in a sense, they did go back there because they're mm-hmm. fulfilling the narrative potential of Conspiracy, but right. they're using the more familiar and much more interesting changelings to tell that infiltration
Good
story
point, yeah.
instead of those parasites.
Yeah, that makes I think that makes a lot of sense. So I wanted to ask you, Chris, I think, you know, as we kind of round the episode down, Shaw apparently got to be Shaw. You know, he had, I think, a breakthrough last week in the sense of kind of seeing some things about himself. But his charm, and I put that in air quotes, is as strong as ever. Especially, you know, when he's making fun of Riker and Picard and the way they, quote unquote, save the galaxy. Uh-huh. And I am wondering with this character, is this storyline, especially with him involved, a way of kind of fully breaking down his complete cynicism against these, quote unquote, heroes? Or is he just never really going to change?
I think he's going to change, but I think it's not easy for him. I feel like he really wants to sidestep danger and I started to say and responsibility, but I don't mean it in the sense of like he wants to avoid responsibility as a captain and as an adult, but he doesn't want to be responsible for something bad that happens to the ship or to the crew or to the Federation, because he's very damaged from the whole Wolf 359 thing, as was revealed in the previous episode. And I think that that has made him try to find, which is kind of odd, I guess, if you're going to be the captain of a starship like the Titan, you're naturally going to find yourself in dangerous situations and have to make hard decisions. And that's what it means to be a captain, especially of a ship of that stature. But he seems like he wants to find a comfortable zone to be able to have the ship and perform his Starfleet duties of exploration. And he wants to take the safe route, right? So if you've got like a, if you've got a straight road from point A to point B, or you can take a little detour winding through the forest and eventually that gets you there, which some people would find far more interesting. He doesn't want to go through the forest. He wants to just go down that straight road and enjoy his dinner and his wine and play it safe. And so I think here, when he saw that they got out of the gravity well problem and he saw an opportunity to return to his routine and get these guys off the ship, and also because he does harbor this resentment against Picard, he would be happy to see Picard and Riker and Seven all get what's coming to them in his eyes. And he's a little bit giddy about that. But I felt like by the end of the episode, he finally listened to Picard said, it's so much worse than we think. You know, we have to run. And finally he says, okay, you know, red alert, let's go. And I think he's starting to come around, and I don't think he's going to continue to be this type of jerk all the way to the end. I think, well, Metallus has said that there's a redemption arc for his character.
Right.
And so I feel like now that we're going to be heading into the final five episodes, I think we're getting close to that point where he's going to start helping more instead of looking for an opportunity to turn everybody in as soon as he can.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting too, because with the way that he portrays the incidences that happened to them, you know, I think that what's fascinating is how each of the ways in which he views those episodes don't have the actual nuance that the stories actually did.
Oh, sure.
And, yeah. You know, how the crew of the Enterprise was always dragged into these episodes, not of their own doing, really. I mean, you even think especially of, you know, when he's making fun of the insurrection story, and how Picard and his crew had nothing to do with that. It's Data going nuts, and then they kind of get dragged into everything. Mm-hmm. They do their due diligence in researching what's going on there and find out, lo and behold, you know, the Federation is doing something it shouldn't be doing here, which is completely immoral. And so, you know, it becomes about perspective. And what we learn in that scene specifically here in this episode is how jaded he is, especially when it comes to these people who are seen as heroes. And I think what's going to be interesting is that he's going to see how easily you can get dragged into these things when it's not necessarily your fault.
I think he's already seeing that. He just doesn't want to admit it yet. He still thinks that that's not him, right?
Yeah. So, you know, I think what's really great, though, about him as a character is that there is this arc for this character to go on. And I'm liking the character, and I'm enjoying him, the portrayal, and I'm wanting to see him go on that journey. And I think that's the best part of the writing is that, you know, as a longtime fan of Star Trek, I'm invested in this character kind of finding his way. And again, this is a DS9 parallel. He is Sisko, but Sisko who was allowed to stew for 30 years. And so to unravel all of that is going to take a lot more time, you know, and I think that what's great about this season is that we're being given then the time to watch that character be able to kind of unpack some of their baggage and let it go, hopefully. Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's what the Titan spinoff series will be about, Matthew.
Let's hope so. from your lips to Paramount Plus's ears.
All right. So a quick thing, we don't need to talk too long about it, but I know how much you love 4K discs, physical discs. ultra high definition, HDR, your TV screen and everything. I've been hearing a lot of talk about or from fans who feel like the show is literally too dark. The way it's shot, that it's too dark, that they can't see what's happening. They can't see the actors. And I've not felt that way, even with my terrible vision, because I'm watching these on a 4K HDR television or on my iPad Pro with its very nice screen and its nice contrast. And I feel like this show is being shot with the best equipment, with the best techniques that allow the filmmakers to tell stories that weren't possible in the past because the technology wasn't there. And now they can shoot things in low light with incredible detail. And it reminds me a bit, I don't know if you've watched C, this TV series called C on Apple TV Plus with Jason Momoa, but it's very dark at times like this as well, but it's beautiful. And the thing is that while the filmmakers are, I think, producing incredible visual fidelity, a lot of people don't have those types of screens to watch this stuff on. And so for them, maybe the product that's being delivered is muddy. Do you have any thought on that?
You know, I know that, and I've seen Metalis actually talk about this on Twitter, because there have been issues with the feed and the file that's actually been given to Paramount Plus, which has actually caused that on some of the different platforms, this unintended darkness. And so there have been issues in that. I think I've never, any time that I've been watching one of the episodes, what I'm watching it on, which is my Apple TV and, you know, 4K television, I've actually not been one of the people that has experienced that. But I know Metalis himself has even said, hey, we're sorry about that. It's actually, it's true. We're working on the file. We're working to get it fixed. And so in the end, you know, I think this does kind of go to show how easy it is for digital files to be corrupted or not quite correct. And so really good formatting on a disc makes a big difference. And so, yeah, this is totally a reason why I want this show on a 4K disc, because I think you've rightly pointed out they have put a lot of effort into making this look like film quality television, and that every episode feels like a mini film, which is fantastic. And I think it deserves to be seen in the highest quality possible. And that's unfortunately not in a streaming format. Because it's compressed, it's, it, you know, there can be mistakes and everything. So, I don't think it's too dark. I think the reason, too, is tonally on purpose. The show is kind of, and in many ways, I've actually kind of seen this. The episodes are slowly lightening. There's felt like there's more light in episodes as we move forward, so that we're moving kind of from a darkness to a lightness by the end of the season. Because I think it's just a thematic element as well.
Yeah, that's a good observation. Yeah.
But I'm, again, the look of this, I was talking to my good friend, Nick Anastasio, who's a, you know, editor for The Bad Batch and, you know, has worked in visual effects. And one of the things we consistently talk about is the look and the feel of the show and just how good it looks. Like, you can see all the money that they've spent on screen. And so I have to continually praise that, because it is, it, you know, the last show that I felt like looked this good was Andor. And that also felt like a film quality show every single week.
Definitely the show. I think it's just beautifully produced. I brought it up in part because I feel like we're at an interesting moment with the technology that storytellers have this ability now that was very difficult before to deal with low lighting. And I'm glad that even if not everyone is able to see it exactly as it's intended right now, I'm glad that it's being shot this way and produced this way, because in the years to come, everybody's screen will improve. And even if it's a streaming copy, the way that is able to be encoded and distributed will also improve. And so for the long term, we're capturing incredible visual storytelling. All right. Well, let's wrap up here. There are many other things we could talk about, but we are running pretty long. So what are your final thoughts and what's your rating for this one?
You know, this was just a huge episode. I think with what happened with Roe and the revelations that we were getting, and then, of course, even accentuating the mystery here with Jack, I think it's great. And, you know, one of the things that I think is so good about this season is that the Jack storyline specifically has been one that you can't just figure out right away.
Right.
And there are some things in the season that, you know, we've been able to rightly call, and that's fun. And I don't think there's anything wrong with being able to predict anything. But I also think that by giving us a mystery to which, you know, you can start to see pieces come together, but you're still not quite sure, is wonderful. And I think the acting in this episode was phenomenal. Everybody was on top of their game 100%. It's one of the best performances I've seen from Patrick Stewart. He just did a great job. Michelle Forbes, too, should be praised for those scenes that they had together. Like you said, Ed Spielers, just so excellent as Jack here. And when he's having that conversation at the end with Beverly, and he's like, I think there's something wrong with me. It's just, it's really well done of this character who's terrified of themselves.
Yeah, yeah.
And so all in all, I would say, man, this is a nigh perfect episode, right? I would give this 9.99999 let's get out of here's.
Great. Yeah. One thing as my final thought, I guess, that I didn't mention as we were discussing it, the fact that Ro Laren shows up and she's Bajoran, the fact that the core of Deep Space Nine was Bajor, and we're dealing with changelings, so we've got the Dominion War element, and now as we're speculating, there could be a Pah Wraith's Prophets element going on here, which would be directly of Bajor. And if you go back to one of the opening scenes of the season, as Picard is going through his belongings in the chateau, on his desk, he has the Bajoran award that he received.
Yes.
And yep. So one of the first visuals of this season is a huge reference to Bajor,
yes,
right there on his desk. And you wonder why. I mean, of course, it's an award he received, and so he has it with him. But why is that prominently shown to us? And then, for a long time, you don't think much about it. But now you start getting into this point of the story, and then you realize maybe that was a clue right there at the beginning.
Yeah. Yep. 100%.
So that's very interesting to me. And yeah, overall, I think the episode is just really well done. We touched on various elements, but kind of scratched the surface, actually, of my very extensive notes on this one. And I have a lot of thoughts about Jack and what's going on with him and some of the other interactions that he had. But we will wrap it up here for now. And I'll give this episode 10 visions from the fire caves.
Excellent.
All right, everyone. We would love to hear your thoughts on imposters. There are many ways for you to share those with us. Perhaps the best way is to go to Facebook and join the Babel Conference. That is our listeners group. It's there to extend the conversation beyond the podcasts. So If you're already a member, you know how it works. But otherwise, just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field. It should come up. If not, type the whole name, the Babel Conference. It is a closed group for listeners, so please answer the questions and agree to the rules of the forum so that I can let you in. You'll find a post there on the timeline for this episode, and you can share your comments there with Matthew and me and fellow listeners. And if you'd like to send us email, you can do that by going to our website, trek.fm/contact. Use the form you find there, choose to send to a show, and choose the artificial tango, and your message will dance its way right over to Matthew and me. And you can also find us in social media. Our username everywhere is TrekFM. And if your podcast app of choice allows you to leave a rating and a review, we would love to get that from you. And thank you so much to everyone who has rated us and reviewed us so far. Now, Matthew, when you're not hearing Beverly's voice calling out to you in your head, where can people find you?
Well, it's not something I want to get rid of, but when I'm not hearing that, you can find me all over the place on social media under the name MattRushing02, most active on Twitter, Instagram, Letterboxd, and Vero. So the same name all over the place. You can also find me, of course, here on the network doing the 602 Club, where we talk about all those other fandoms outside of Star Trek. So I hope you'll check that out. We have a blast over there. You can also find Literary Treks, talking about the books and the comics of Star Trek. Chris, you and I do The Orb, where we're doing a 30th anniversary rewatch of Star Trek Deep Space Nine. Warp 5, we've got the 20th anniversary rewatch of Star Trek Enterprise. And Saddle Up, where we're talking about Strange New Worlds, which is going to be coming back soon. We can't wait for that. And then you can find me over on the Nerd Party Network talking about Harry Potter, one chapter at a time, and Owl Post. And Aggressive Negotiations, where I'm talking about Star Wars. But Chris, when you're not trying to find where you can get one of those brand new Starfleet uniforms, where can people find you?
Yeah, I want one of those, and I'm going to get two mobile emitters and slap one on each arm.
Oh, nice.
Really.
Whoa,
showing
talk
off.
About bling.
Bling, bling, for sure. You can find me elsewhere here on the network. Of course, as you mentioned, you and I do all of those shows together. Larry Nemechek and I do The Ready Room from time to time. And you can find me in many episodes in the back catalog across many shows. And when I'm not doing that, I'm busy writing, producing magazines, all that stuff here in Japan. But I would love to chat with you in social media about Star Trek or whatever you'd like to chat about. You can find me everywhere under the username C. Brian Jones, letter C and Brian with a Y. Twitter's where I'm most active, but that is my username all over the place. And you can also find me on Mastodon, if that's where you are, on the Trekkies.social instance. And I'd love to chat with you in social media. If you would like to help us keep this show and everything that we're doing on the network going, we could definitely use your help. To find out how to support the network, just go to patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. You can become an associate producer of this show or another show and help us keep the rewatches going and get involved in other ways. We would love to have your support. So thank you to everyone who's helping us right now. We would not be here without you. Well, Matthew, I'm looking forward to next time when we find out just what the bounty is.
Well, Chris, I can't wait. So let's get out of here.